Hi, I'm Maya Garantz.
And I'm Rebecca Cohen.
And this is The Sauce, the culture and politics podcast where we drink cocktails and ruin the stuff you love.
On this episode, we are just going to ruin a bunch of stuff. Maya, you had some stuff you wanted to talk about. What are we going to talk about for you?
It's been a long time coming that we've needed to talk about the TV show The Voice and ruining it.
Okay.
How about you?
Well, I really want to talk about Tim Burton movies because I watched The Nightmare Before Christmas a few weeks ago when it was Halloween. And I just realized that it has some problems and I want to dive into that.
All right, let's do it.
What are you drinking this week, Maya?
I made myself a sort of rum cranberry spritzy situation, and it's a bit of a failure, I have to say.
Oh, no.
I was trying to do things that were just easy. I mean, I'll still drink it, but I was trying to just do something easy and juicy and fruity, and I'm kind of like, oh, I should have actually planned this a little more carefully.
But is it that the flavors just don't quite go together?
It's not quite working, and I think that the fizzy water that I put in might have lost its fizz, so it just watered it down a little bit. It's a little bit of a failure. Still, I will drink it. And you, what are you drinking?
I am drinking hot cocoa with Sambuca in it. Yeah, it's kind of a
that
treat.
That is so cozy.
Yeah, it's freezing cold outside. It's been getting progressively colder day by day here in New York. But today, this evening, it's just so cold. So I got home and I was like, if I'm going to drink a cocktail, it's going to be a nice, cozy Sambuca-based cocktail.
And how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I'm pretty excited that it's Thanksgiving. I'm kind of trying to deal with this news of Amazon coming to Long Island City.
Oh, my God.
Which is going to ruin my life. So that's kind of a bummer. But it's almost the holidays and I got some hot cocoa. How are you doing?
Well, I have to say I am doing so much better since the election. So much better. It's amazing how much the burden of all three branches of the government being in the hands of these like horrible people and there being no accountability was truly pressing down on my soul.
Yeah.
Since we last recorded, the blue wave has only gotten wavier. We won Senate seat in Arizona.
Has
not had a Democratic senator since 1976.
Yes.
What? So in our lifetime.
Yeah. So Kyrsten Sinema won in Arizona. We won a bunch of seats in California, particularly in the Orange County area.
Woo-woo. Swing SoCal left. Those people have been just organizing the fuck out of things for 2 years. Fucking Rohrabacher's seat done. Mm-hmm. Katie Porter just took a lead in the polls in the voting. Like, she's going to beat Mimi fucking Walters. Gil Cisneros, it's looking real good for him.
Yep.
I also see this note. Amar Kampanajar is fucking hot.
Oh, yeah. So
care to get into that?
Yes, I would care to get into that. So a few episodes ago when we looked at the campaign ads of the midterms, one of the ads we looked at was from the San Diego congressional race where, what's his name? What's the Republican guy's name?
Duncan Hunter.
Duncan Hunter. Thank you.
Dirty Duncan Hunter.
I have a weird block where I can never remember Duncan Hunter's name, I think because my brain is just like trying to erase him from existence.
Protecting itself. Yeah, it's protecting itself.
So Duncan Hunter had this horrible ad that was about his opponent, Amar Kampanajar.
Well, okay. But to be fair, Amar Kampanajar is both Mexican and Palestinian.
Exactly.
So if he's going to be like that, he's going to have to expect the most racist ad of the 2018 midterm.
good victim blaming there. But yeah. Yeah. He's like an obvious target, right? So the ad from Duncan Hunter was portraying him as a terrorist and not in like coded terms or whatever. It was like, this man's a terrorist. He's going to blow you up. And we were.
And he comes from terrorists. And also, if that isn't bad enough, he's Mexican too. I mean, It's so fucking bad.
It's terrible.
It's so dirty. It's disgusting.
But what I did not know was what Amar Campanajar actually looks like. I hadn't seen any pictures of him, really. And my husband, Matt, just last night, we were talking about it, and he's like, have you seen pictures of him? And I was like, what? Does he look like a scary terrorist or something? He's like, no, just look him up. And I did. And he's fucking hot. He's a perfectly formed human. He looks so good. He's beautiful. He's a model. I don't know why he wants to be in Congress. He should be a model.
It depends on the camera angle. I mean, for me, it really depends on the camera angle.
Yes.
But he does have that very glossy, like he mm-hmm. should be in GQ kind of. When the camera gets him right, it's a very GQ kind of like suaveness going on. Absolutely.
And nobody told me this. And what I feel frustrated by is like, this should have been a thing. Like, where was Twitter? Where was the internet and social media? Why was this not a meme? Why was this not a thing that this super hot guy is running for Congress?
Well, I think that Beto got all of that.
I know. And I get it. Like, I saw the steak thing. Did you see the Instagram steak thing? He made a steak on Instagram and everyone was going crazy because he was like slicing a steak and then he licked his finger and women were like swooning.
You know, I have to say, I feel like what Beto is revealing is an inability to like put the social media down, like return back to life. And this is a reminder of why people who choose to go into politics often sometimes have some problems with needing to be loved by too many people. And like, yeah. Wait, did we get to talk about the fact that Ariana Grande broke up?
And Pete Davidson, no, we never talked about that.
We never talked about that because you know what? Sometimes the clitoral stimulation and the hot sex is very exciting in that first month. And then you have to get to know the person. Yeah. And it's very disappointing.
Yeah.
And I've been there. I've been there. I was so not surprised by it. And I was like, wow.
Oh, when I heard the news. Right, but yeah. When I heard the news, I absolutely thought of what you said about it when we talked about it, which was like she had that look on her face of a young woman who had experienced orgasm for the first time. And it's true. You were very right in terms of looking at the pictures of them together. But that also comports completely with the outcome of the relationship, which is she was head over heels. She was swept off her feet by whatever techniques he was able to employ. But yes, eventually you start getting to know the person. And then you're like, you know, I can do this myself.
Yeah, I can do this myself. Now that I've figured out how to do this, I'm sure I can do this with someone else.
I can teach others. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry it didn't work out for them, honestly, but they're young and they have many adventures ahead. So, all right, before we get into our topics like The Voice, what's your plans for Thanksgiving?
I have been doing Friendsgiving with the same group of friends since 1996.
Oh, wow.
So this is my friend Liz and my friend Gabriel. And over the years, various people we've been sleeping with came and went. And then all of us ended up with partners. And then all of us ended up having kids. So we just get drunk and cook all day and we're together and it's wonderful because we're like children of immigrants and orphans and we're all kind of oddballs. So Thanksgiving doesn't really have meaning.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So we've created meaning around it and it's wonderful. And you?
Well, I am going to be having Thanksgiving in the local area in New Jersey with my sister's father-in-law, my sister's in-laws. It'll be fun. It'll be nice. I don't have to cook anything or do anything. Just show up.
That's great. And not talk politics and it'll be fine.
That's going to be the trick. I will have to make sure we deftly avoid anything coming close.
Yeah. I mean, I think setting the rule is really important. Just saying we're not doing this. We're not having this conversation.
Yeah. We're going to have to do that.
But also what's really nice about Thanksgiving is that it always inspires my husband, who is a chef, in his spare time to get very exciting with the turkey.
Have you guys ever deep fried a turkey?
That we have not done because we do not have a deep fryer.
Okay.
And I don't think we're going to get a deep fryer because that's the opposite. Isn't that the opposite of what old people are supposed to be doing? Like we're getting old. We're starting to gain weight. We should not have a deep fryer.
No, you need a midlife crisis fryer. as you reach middle age and you start to wonder what happened to your youth, you try to regain it by heating oil to dangerously high temperatures and dunking wet turkeys inside. It's not only an amazing way to make a delicious turkey, but there's also, like, you know, real risk involved. It's a real daredevil activity. What are some of the ways you've prepared turkey?
Well, it's interesting because this year the word is brining was bullshit, which is like crazy. Because when we were first together, it was like brining was the whole thing.
Oh, do you remember
America's Test Kitchen? Like, that was the whole thing. We're going to like make 3,000 turkeys and do it in all these different ways. And we tell you brining works. So we've been brining for years. And now there is an article being like, brining is a lie.
Wait, you can't just say America's Test Kitchen's scientifically arrived at conclusions are a lie.
I'm reading this from the New York Times, Sam Sifton. Mm-hmm. Do you brine your Thanksgiving turkey? I have. I've also worn very, very skinny ties and blah, 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 blah. Now I just salt the bird and let it sit in the fridge to dry for a day or so before roasting. That's called dry brining. That is brining.
Yeah.
But apparently, Kim Severson explored the subject of turkey brines for the food desk of the New York Times this week, and discovering how after two decades of flying high, the practice has been losing altitude among the food media influencers who first sent it soaring. A lot of people are over brining.
Well, I understand that. There have to be trends. You have to come up with a big new thing. But I don't know. If America's Test Kitchen found that it was the best, I trust them.
I know.
So no brining.
Although, again, dry brining is salting it and letting it air dry. Anyway.
Well, is that what you're going to do? What are you guys going to do?
We've had different things over the year. When my first crazy boss in New York, who's psychotic, did leave me with one good thing, which is she taught me that if you wrap a turkey in bacon, then the turkey bastes in the bacon fat. So it keeps it really juicy. God. So we wrap the turkey in bacon and then we baste it with apple cider. So that's something that we did for years.
Okay, that sounds amazing.
It is amazing. It's really, really good. And then what we discovered last year is that a lot of times people will sell just the saddle of the turkey, meaning just the dark meat, because people want to, like, you know, makes turkey breast, whatever, with the turkey breast. And we only ever want to eat the dark meat. So that was just when we thought that there was nowhere else to go with our various, like,
experimentations,
we learned about that. So that was very exciting.
So you've done that, the dark meat only thing.
We've done the dark meat only thing. And I think this year, Ben is thinking about smoking the turkey.
Have you ever done that before?
Not a turkey. We've smoked chickens and ducks.
Okay. So you have a smoker.
Yes.
Okay. So why would you not smoke a turkey? That sounds fantastic.
I think it's going to be great. I love smoked poultry.
You have to do that and then come back and report to our listeners how that went.
I will. Excellent. I will.
And I'm going to eat whatever my sister's father-in-law serves. And I'm going to like it.
I have long wanted to get into the TV show The Voice, which is now on its, like, 70,000th season. I mean, they do two of them a year. And I both find it repugnant and yet somewhat educational and yet terrible and yet compelling. And I have to figure this out.
Okay.
Like, I find it morally wrong, and yet I can't not watch it. But I don't actually watch it when it's live on TV, but I watch it on YouTube the next day. I don't know.
Okay. I have a lot of questions because, first of all, I have never seen an episode of The Voice in my entire life. My only knowledge of The Voice is the ads that I've seen on the network between programs promoting it. So my impression of it is, this is the one where you have three judges, and one of them is Christina Aguilera sometimes.
You have four judges, one of whom is sometimes Christina Aguilera, yes.
And they're sitting in chairs with their backs to the stage, so they can't see the person. So unlike pop idol, unlike Americans Top Idol or whatever the fuck it's called, they don't like I'm not so above pop culture that I can't remember the name. I just honestly am losing my mind. What is it, American Idol? Is that that's the show, right?
It's American Idol, yeah.
Okay. They're not judging the person based on presentation, having the right look, to speak.
It's just their voice. Yes.
And then there's a thing where they press a button and their chair turns around, which means it's good. They like the person and want to see
that. That's when they're saying yes. And each of the judges has a team. Mm-hmm. And this is the part of the show that is what the show is about.
Okay.
The first round is this blind thing, where it's like blind audition.
Okay.
Where solely based on the voice of the singer, they press a button. And then at the end of it, whoever gets a button pressed and the chair to turn ends up going to the next round, even if they only get one. And if more than one judge presses the button, then they have to sort of abjectly beg this singer to join their team. So these stars are sort of put in this position where they're like, join my team. If you join my team, you'll win.
Okay. I get it.
Each of the judges has a team of people who they purportedly coach throughout the process. So as long as they're on the show, they belong to that team.
Okay. So over the course of the season, you follow the teams.
Yes.
Okay. So it's the beginning of the season where they're selecting their teams. And then what happens?
And being selected by these singers. Because if singers get like more than one chair turn, they get to decide which team they want to go on to.
And then once the teams are selected, they go on to more rounds of singing competition?
More rounds of singing competition. And then it kind of turns into like American Idol, more like American Idol, but with that sense that they're somehow getting mentored by these stars. Right,
these real pop stars.
Yeah.
Does the audience vote? Do the viewers vote?
The viewers vote. Once they do these first rounds where it's all dependent on the coaches, and who goes through depends on the coaches. Mm-hmm. And then they get down to these finalists, I don't know, like 10 of them or 12 of them. Then it becomes like American Idol and it's all about who votes for them.
But like, do people get eliminated because it's on teams? So they just, it's basically American Idol.
It's basically American Idol with this initial stage. Yeah.
Yeah. Being slightly
but also
different.
With teams. Yeah. And this sort of fantasy of mentorship.
The fantasy of mentorship. I feel like that is an important element.
Yes,
it is. Okay. So what is it that's troubling you about this show, Maya?
I feel like part of what's troubling me is the fact that I watch it.
Like, have you watched every season?
No. Not nearly. Not at all. But what happens is, and the way the shows hook you, is when there is one person who you get invested in. I remember the one season I ever watched American Idol. It's because there was this singer, and it was the Jordan Sparks season, and she went on to become this like big pop star.
Right.
But there was this singer, Melinda, who was like a backup singer, and this was going to be her chance to really shine. And she was amazing, frankly. And for some reason, I saw some video of her. This was like over 10 years ago. But then I got invested in Melinda. And that's what keeps you watching.
To root
for these people who you get invested in. And so any season I've ever watched, it's because like the blind part is very compelling because it's like they can't see them. It doesn't matter what they look like. It's all about their voice. And you have the sense of like, these are experts and they can just know from a voice. And isn't that interesting? It makes you think about a voice and like, what is it? And that's kind of fascinating. And any season where one of the people has been compelling and I'm compelled to see how they do, I sort of get sucked in to following the rest of the season.
Well, that sounds great.
Here's the thing that's troubling. There are many things that are troubling about the show.
I'm listening. I'm open to it.
One of which is that with every passing year that shows like this exist, the fantasy that this is the sort of potential springboard for an unrecognized talent becomes more and more transparently a fraud.
Yeah.
Like the first American Idol, Kelly Clarkson, and she's actually one of the judges on The Voice right now.
Oh, no shit.
That's
like
her
kind of weirdly meta, yeah.
It is. And actually, another one of the judges this season is Jennifer Hudson, who also came to national attention from American Idol. But there have been so many years and so many seasons of all of these shows. Mm-hmm. And so at this point, there have been dozens of winners of these shows. How many of them actually have careers, and how many of them are like doing open mic night in like Cleveland? You know what I mean?
Right.
The fantasy, the thrill is gone. The thrill is gone. And you realize like, oh, this is just a machine to make more money for these judges who are getting paid, who play this game like they're going to help these people, and then they don't end up having careers.
It kind of makes me think of The Bachelor / Bachelorette, which I also have never watched an episode of, I have to admit.
I haven't either.
But the premise of that show, in season one, it was like, oh my God, whoever gets picked, they're going to marry her. Wow. Right. Like that was a thing. And then... Right. And then like 15 seasons later, you're like, maybe they'll get married. Maybe not. Probably not. Like, not like the stakes aren't like quite so high.
Totally.
Not that we all like really believed. I don't know. I never watched it. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we should interview someone who's been a devoted watcher of The Bachelor, because people do really enjoy it. But it's more about the competition and coming out as the winner than it's about this promise of the marriage or the pop stardom or whatever like life-changing prize you're supposed to be winning.
Well, there's also this other thing, I think, with these talent shows, because I had a very intense love of So You Think You Can Dance for a few years there. I mean, this was a while back because they started making changes that just ruined the show. But what you notice in the best of these shows is that when certain talented people get the opportunity and get the resources, you actually do see them get better. It's incredible. Like you see these people sort of like blossom into this certain talent, and it can be really extraordinary to watch. And then sometimes people you don't expect are the ones who start getting better and who sort of thrive, and some people sort of plateau out. And it's really interesting in that way. Another problem, though, is that they're still doing karaoke. So it's like anybody can be a good karaoke singer, but ultimately that's not what's going to make a star. What makes a star is getting to have really good songs that, like, it ends up being very revelatory about what makes stardom happen.
Yeah, that's actually quite interesting, because there's this phenomenon where, particularly in pop music, I think the fiction that somehow, Madonna used to claim that she co-wrote her songs. And we're like, yeah, Madonna has a creative input, at least. These are her songs. But now it's like, we don't care. Somebody writes the songs. They got some producer. They've got this fucking catalog of 500 songs. A pop star, potential pop star comes along, and they're like, they go through their catalog and find one that this might fit you.
Well, but also the best songs go to the best,
most
famous people.
Right.
And actually, one good thing that I learned from watching The Voice is that when you listen to amateurs sing songs by people like Katy Perry, you realize, oh, Katy Perry's a real singer. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it does make you acknowledge the talent, because I feel like I have very low opinions of pop stars. But then when you have like just Joe Schmo sing that song, you're like, oh. That song is a hard song. I never even thought of it that way.
I have great respect for pop stars, I have to say. Not every single one of them, but like singing and dancing at the same time is really hard. I know they have backup tracks. I know they're lip syncing a lot, but like they work, man. They work.
They do. But again, the problem is that you know these people are not going to go on to have careers. There's so much pressure put on them. Mm-hmm. And they're just object, they end up just being widgets, and it makes it worse that they're widgets in this public way where they're being told that they're not widgets, when actually they are super just widgets.
Okay. So I think this is a problem on all reality competition shows, now that I think about it, because there's also like Top Chef and the fashion designer one, Project Runway, and it's like the premise of everyone is like, the person who wins this, if you win this, your dress is going to be on the cover of Vogue. You know, you're going to be the next
change big designer. Your life. That's yeah. right.
And it's like, it's a $100,000 prize and maybe like an internship somewhere. It's never right. like life-changing prize, but right. but the premise of the show is that, oh, just the exposure is going to like totally change your life. And there have been a few people who've come out of Project Runway and become legitimate designers. I can't speak for the Top Chef winners. I have no idea. Maybe we can look into that. But it does, yeah, I do think that's just inherent to the genre that over time it loses that urgency and that feeling of stakes because you come to realize that it is a fiction.
And we have to talk about the douchiness of Adam Levine.
Okay.
And Blake, what's his name? Shelton. Blake Shelton. We're going to have to talk about the douchiness of Adam Levine and Blake Shelton.
Adam Levine is the guy from
Maroon 5, which is a band yeah. that I literally had never heard a single song by.
Oh.
In my whole, and I listen to a lot of music, and like maybe I'd heard a song because it's playing mm-hmm. in a store somewhere, but I'd never actually like knew of them as a thing.
Yeah, you didn't have two nieces and a nephew that had bar mitzvahs within the last few years.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
So basically, Adam Levine is like the rocker guy, and he's like the alternative guy. And Blake Shelton is like the country guy. And they've been on every single fucking season.
Okay.
So it's like the two white guys anchor it. And then it's a rotating thing where it used to be like there was a black guy and a white woman. And like finally at some point they actually had a black woman. And now they have two women. And it's like, ooh.
Oh. So there's two white guys who are like – the main cast and then a rotating yes. cast of others.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, that already is like, ooh.
And you can tell that at this point, any excitement they might have initially felt about mentoring or about being part of this, it's like they are just fucking clocking in and getting their check and making promises to kids that they know they cannot keep. And also Adam Levine is just so douchey and mm-hmm. Blake Shelton, they're like so douchey. Like they could not be more douchey.
Yeah, I only know Adam Levine from Maroon 5 like videos, and he just has a douchey quality about him. His whole mien is just like yes. douchey.
Da douche. It's like yeah. it is yeah. so the douchey.
Whole, yeah.
And Blake Shelton is like country boy, country, and he like doesn't write his own songs, and it's like he's just like country singer, country boy, party country, country guy, and you're like, oh, he's like dude bro country.
Yeah, but you got to represent that demographic,
right? And actually he does the best in terms of translating his kind of country stars who come through that into actually like country music has the most space for like voice contestants.
That's interesting. So when yeah. a contestant first comes on and they're doing the blind competition part, they're choosing what karaoke they're going to do, right?
Yes, they choose their karaoke.
So if they do a country song, aren't they essentially saying, Blake, pick me?
Yes, they are. Yes, they
Is
are.
Adam and the other black and or female people ever going to pick the country singers?
No, they sometimes pick the country singers, but the country singers always pick Blake because he has the best track record, I think, post voice.
Okay. So
there's, I think, the most room in a country market for like new people who come up through there.
So his team members who've won or done well on the show have had the best record of actually having a career in country music.
Yes.
Whereas, like, somehow the guy from Maroon 5 just hasn't been making careers like you would think.
He has not. And it's like, oh, I don't know. I don't know why I'm watching. Like, why am I, like, getting my hopes up for these people
who, I don't know.
Who just are trying so hard? I don't know.
Why are you watching?
I don't know because there are people who I'm, like, buying into. There's this one singer. She's really good. I don't know.
What attracts you to a contestant on the show and makes you want to root for them?
When they're really good and you know that there's a reason why, like, physically or in some way, they're just too weird to have made it just based on their incredible raw talent. And I think that there's also a way in which when you see the people who are actually stars react emotionally to the raw power of somebody's talent, because they're sitting there.
Sure.
And there are times when these singers will do something and you'll see these famous people be like, oh my God, you're so good. And I think there's something about that that's okay. very, that it's like, but I'm a sucker.
How much of that is an act? How much of that is them playing to this narrative?
They're very good actors. That's okay. the whole thing.
Right. Well, they are like professional performers.
They're professional performers, right.
All right.
It's a really weird thing. Like, I think it's repugnant. And yet now that I've watched a couple of the blind auditions and there are a couple of singers who I'm bought into for this season, I'm going to be following them until they're out of the competition.
It's too late. You're in now. You're in.
I'm in. Ugh.
I don't tend to get drawn into singing competitions so much. With singing competitions, I feel less excited about it because I feel like so many people can sing really well. Many people sing really well and they're just like fronting a cover band somewhere or a right. bar mitzvah band. You know what I mean?
Right.
And they're like so skilled and they're real pros. And it makes it sound like I'm saying singers are completely replaceable, but you know what? They are.
They are. They are.
They are.
But then what makes a singer irreplaceable? And that's why you have like
the question.
That's the question. That's why like Bohemian Rhapsody or like whatever the Freddie Mercury movie. Like, what is it about Freddie Mercury's voice?
I actually heard a piece on NPR a few years ago that was like scientifically examining that question. What is it about Freddie Mercury's voice? Where they analyzed his voice in terms of like frequencies and whatever
wow.
other ways you could analyze a sound. Yeah. And I fucking wish I could remember what their conclusion was. I'm probably going to get this wrong, but I feel like it had to do with, they said it was the, what you might call the flaws in the voice that gave it its unique. Yeah. That like, it was the not holding a note consistently, but sort of like wavering, and not in a, like a perfect vibrato way, but wavering in an inconsistent way around a note that gave the voice its uniquely compelling quality. Yeah, I'll have to look up that piece and see if I can find out what they said.
And it's interesting because then there's a show like X Factor. Mm-hmm. I think it's called X Factor, where the shtick of that show is that people come out and they just seem like fucking schmo, Joe Schmo loser dude. And then they surprise the judge because they whip out some voice. They're just like,
they come out
and they're like, I pick up trash. I'm a trash man. And they have a fucked up snaggle tooth and they're kind of shy and totally socially awkward. And you know that they're going to be just humiliated. And then they like open up their voice and everybody is shocked at the shock of the talent and the trash man. Like, that's the appeal of that show. That's the like,
well,
win.
That was like
the emotional win of that.
What was
show.
Her name? Susan Boyle?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
She
came out looking like a dumpy woman and everyone laughed at her because it was set up that way. And then
she was awkward.
But she went on to record some albums and shit, so that's real, man. It's real. It changes lives. Just believe, Maya. Just buy in. Buy in. Okay, it's my turn to talk about my thing.
Yes.
A couple weeks ago was Halloween. I have a tradition in my household where while getting ready for Halloween, while putting on our costumes, we put on Nightmare Before Christmas.
And how long have you been doing this?
I don't know. I used to have it on VHS, so a while.
A while. Yeah.
Yeah. So while watching it this past Halloween, I just noticed some serious problems with the Nightmare
Only
Before
now
Christmas.
You've noticed?
I
after
don't
all
know.
These, how
I
many
never,
times have you seen this movie?
I could never count.
Okay.
I couldn't count. I couldn't tell you.
Okay.
I don't know. I hadn't really thought about it. Like, I've always noticed issues. I've noticed like that Sally's kind of pushed to the side but that's just sort of typical, you know, Hollywood movie where the female love interest is peripheral and all that stuff.
Right.
And there's other issues I've always kind of noticed, but like, I don't know why. Maybe in past years I've been just listening to the soundtrack and not really watching the movie.
Right.
But I noticed really what a fucking asshole Jack is. He's terrible. And ultimately, okay, let me start with this.
Okay.
Nightmare Before Christmas, first of all, is the most Tim Burton of Tim Burton movies, even though I know Tim Burton did not direct it. He kind of co-wrote it. He came up with the story. He produced it. But like, in a way, it's the most Tim Burton movie. And what I mean by that is like, a lot of Tim Burton movies, for a while, all Tim Burton movies, but he's kind of branched out, are about a gothic artist hero who is misunderstood and doesn't fit into society and generally hurts people. His art makes him hurt people inadvertently, maybe intentionally, like with Sweeney Todd, but like, that's part of being an artist, which drives people away from him.
Don't you think that actually, like, Edward Scissorhands is the more...
No, yeah, I mean, like, that's a good contender. Like, that fits the bill very well. I will agree. Edward Scissorhands embodies that really well. The one thing I can say about Edward Scissorhands is that there's a variety of female characters in that movie.
Yes.
And while there's, like, a pretty clear defining line of like, these are the good ladies who take care of Edward, and these are the bad ladies who try to use him and are mean to him.
Yeah.
At least there's like some variation. Whereas the Nightmare Before Christmas, really the only substantial female character is Sally, whose job is to just be perpetually supportive and kind and like the wet blanket voice of reason that no one's going to listen to, but then is going to forgive everything in the end. Tim Burton's movies have a problem with women. And I want to get into that in a second. But let's talk about Nightmare Before Christmas specifically.
Yes.
So it kind of embodies that, right? Jack is this artist. And the rest of Halloween Town is just his audience. They love what he does. Like, they're all working together to create Halloween or whatever, but... when it's all over, they're like, you did great, Jack.
Right.
That was the best Halloween ever. Jack, you're amazing.
We couldn't do anything without you. You are everything.
He's everything. He's everything. But he's so unsatisfied. So right there, as I'm watching this, the opening, and Jack goes to his soliloquy, I'm like, oh, get fucking over yourself. You have this audience who adore you and love everything you do and think you are the best. But he's not satisfied because it's grown stale. He's tired of doing the same old thing. Mm. And there's a kind of contempt for the audience that runs throughout the movie. Because not only do they love Jack, even though his art has grown stale, and they just want the same old crap, but also when he comes to them with something fresh and exciting because he's been to Christmastown, and he's like, let me give you this new, inspiring, exciting new thing, they don't get it at all.
Right.
They just are stuck in their thing. Nobody gets Jack. I mean, and then that's part of the thing. He has to be kind of like separate from society and marginal from society because he's the artist. But implied in there is this real contempt for your audience. This idea that they don't even know what's fucking good. The audience will just eat up whatever crap you give them and they don't even know what's good.
Well, and also they can't keep up with you. It's so painful to be just years ahead of their ability to catch up to it. That's so hard.
You're doing real art and they just want, you know, your manufactured pop. So that I thought was really interesting. And then the whole role of Sally is really interesting. Because she is the person who from the very start is like, this is a bad idea.
Right.
Everyone else in Halloween Town's like, we don't get it, but we love you, Jack. We'll do whatever you say. And Sally's like, I'm having a premonition. I don't think this is going to work out. And And Jack ignores her and treats her like shit.
Right.
And then, of course, it doesn't work out.
Right.
And Jack, you know, fucks everything up. And then I find it interesting that in order to save the day, Jack has to rescue Santa Claus, the other like male genius artist.
Genius.
Yeah.
Right.
So like he gets the male genius artist of Christmas to save the day. And then he's like, Sally, become my girlfriend and everything's okay. She, like, there's no, gosh, maybe you should be in charge of Halloween Town, Sally, because right. you seem to know right. what the fuck is going on.
Right. right. You know what's going on. You don't hate your audience. Yeah. You're not like over it. You actually still love the job.
Yeah.
And yeah.
yeah.
No, but no. her win is to be his love.
Exactly. She stays true. She makes him his suit. She makes him the Santa suit, even though she knows it's wrong, because she's that kind of girl. She's always going to accommodate him. And what's fucked up about it is that ultimately the message is Jack is bored in his zone. He is tired of being in his lane and he wants to branch out creatively. And his audience is like not into it. And he does it. And ultimately the message is don't branch out creatively.
Yes.
It's like you'll just fuck everything up.
So right.
It almost contradicts itself in that way. And, you know, he ends with more inspiration for Halloween. So you could kind of say that really the message isn't that. The message is break out of your comfort zone. Fuck everything up. Go take someone else's art and fuck right. it up. And that will inspire right. you to make your art better. That's kind of messed up.
It's messed up and revelatory about Tim Burton. I mean, that's the yeah. thing, is that this was like when we had that earlier episode about like Phantom Thread, about all of these like middle-aged white guys having movies about middle-aged white guys having artistic crises. And you're like, yes. hey guys.
And we didn't talk about Nightmare Before Christmas, but we probably should have in that episode.
Well, yeah, because he really showed them how it was done. Exactly. I mean, really, they're all following his lead. Like Tim Burton is at his best. I feel like he's at his best when it is something like Mars Attacks. Mars Attacks, Beetlejuice is the greatest.
So Beetlejuice is great, but he didn't write the script for Beetlejuice. And, okay. And Batman 1 is great. And I feel like it's yes. fucking underrated. And you know what? It's better than any Christopher Nolan Batman
yes,
movie.
Yes, it is. Oh, and the first Batman movie is fantastic.
Yeah. And everyone who's listening, you can at me, you can whatever, bring it, because Batman 1989 is the best Batman movie. But those were scripts written by other people. So Tim Burton, when he's in charge of the story, starts to kind of go off the rails sometimes. Like when Batman right. Returns, there's a lot of good stuff in that movie. I would categorize that with other Tim Burton movies, like Batman is the tortured artist who's separate right. from society and misunderstood. The one credit I can give it is that the main female character being Catwoman forces Burton to explore some ideas about women, women in the workplace, women feeling neglected, abused, marginalized, and trying to regain her power. So it's like, it's kind of okay. And he tries to bring these characters together on their dual identities and their, you know, psychic right. Division, having that in common, which puts his male and female character kind of like on an equal level,
right.
which is actually quite rare for a Tim Burton movie.
Yes, it is.
Whereas if you take, okay, Sweeney Todd, which again, I think fits the bill. It's a tortured artist guy. He hurts people as part of his art. Society loves his art, but they don't understand right. him. It's like,
they don't understand.
It's exactly.
Yeah.
It's all that shit. And he cast his, at the time, life partner, Helena Bonham Carter, in the role of
Mrs. Lovett.
Mrs. Lovett. Thank you. You know, he didn't write the character Mrs. Lovett. This is not a script he wrote, but her and his interpretation of Mrs. Lovett is very interesting in that film. It really highlighted how manipulative she was and the extent to which she was trying to divert Sweeney from his art.
Yes.
Or like sort of pretending to be invested in it just in order to sort of grab him as her man.
Right.
Okay. There's also like the blonde girl in that movie, as in Edward Scissorhands, where you have Winona Ryder as this like blonde, naif, sweet ingenue. Yeah.
Angel.
His attitudes toward women and the roles he allows them to play are interesting. Let's just leave it at that.
I'm surprised you'd leave it at that. But I feel like of all the Tim Burton movies, Nightmare Before Christmas is the one that you make the most stuff by. The one that you have the most like greeting cards based on.
Oh, and
birthday balloons and like the most crap. Like it is the most crap producing movie that he ever made.
That's true. I mean, part of that has to do with it being an animated film.
Yes.
And being a Disney film.
Yes.
Years ago, actually 10 years ago, Matt and I went to Disneyland. I want to say it was the day after Christmas with my sister and her family. Yeah. Okay. Don't ever go to Disneyland the day after Christmas. Like, why would anyone do that? Why? But we were doing it because my sister wanted to, because they were in town. So just to give you a picture of the day, we got in line at whatever, 9 a.m. And it was already hundreds and hundreds of people, like throngs of people pushing to get into the park. We waited in line, we got the tickets, we got in. And by 10 a.m. they had closed the doors because the park was at capacity. The point of the story being it was Christmas, so the whole park was decorated for Christmas. Yay, Christmas at Disneyland. And I kept seeing people in Jack Skellington sweatshirts. And I was like, that's cool. Where did they get those? And then we got to the Haunted Mansion. And the Haunted Mansion was all decorated with Nightmare Before Christmas stuff. I was like, well, that's fucking genius, right? It's the Halloween version of Christmas. It's perfect. And also allows the park an opportunity to sell a wealth of merchandise that a lot of people were happy to buy.
Have you ever heard of Bat's Day in the Sun?
No. What is Bat's Day in the Sun?
It's the day at Disneyland when all the goths come to Disneyland.
Oh my God. Are you serious?
Oh, I'm serious. I'm serious. It's called Bat's Day in the Sun, and the goths take over Disneyland.
That's not goth.
It is so. Are you kidding me? It's so. I'm going to send you.
I mean,
it's so good.
That's really interesting to me. As someone like you and I, we were not goths in high school, but we were goth adjacent.
We were goth adjacent, yeah.
And I definitely had friends who were goths, and we definitely went to Disneyland. There's a weird way in which Disney just sort of transcends all of that. It's also weird to be a goth in Southern California. That's its whole own thing. It's its whole own thing.
Do you remember there was like that one goth dance night in San Diego?
Oh, yeah. It was
called Soil.
I do. I remember going to it. Yeah. I mean, it's sunny 350 days a year there. It's fucking beautiful. There's beaches, and our high school had surfing as a PE option. Like you could take surfing instead of gym.
Yes. Yes.
So being a goth there was its own kind of special thing.
Okay. It's go to Instagram, everybody, right now. Hashtag Bat's Day in the Fun Park.
Bat's Day in the Fun Park.
Yes. And that's where you will see the goths.
Goths at Disneyland.
Bat's Day, yeah.
Like goths on Splash Mountain.
Goths on Splash Mountain. Goths in their full gothiest of attire.
Goths on the Dumbo ride.
And they come in. And it's not just that they're goths. They come in their most like fetish attire. Like it's like.
Well, you have to, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You got to really make a statement.
They've been doing it for like 20 years.
Okay. Sure.
And I think we can blame Jack Skellington for that.
Well, there's an obvious tie-in.
Yes.
As that's a Disney movie, and I think it just gives license. But I think that there's an extent to which that whole aesthetic of gothiness has gotten this like candy coating.
Yeah.
In large part because of Tim Burton.
That's what I'm saying. It's like he's neutering. There's that thing where his aesthetic that he brought to the big screen when he did it, it was so exciting and weird and alternative.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it gets neutered by being turned into this like big budget thing.
Yeah.
So he is always in this place where, like, if he was going to be for real, he never had to make big budget fucking Hollywood movies.
Right.
He could have just made weird shit the whole time. So he as an artist is always stuck in that like loathing of himself while trying to be, quote, true to himself. But maybe being true to himself is just being a fucking sellout. Like, that's Tim Burton.
Yeah.
Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which was his first movie. What's amazing about that movie, it's that it's so fucking weird.
Yeah.
It's just weird, weird, weird. And Beetlejuice, he didn't write the script, but it's weird. And as the movies go on, you see this thing where it's like this tension between somebody who's supposed to be so different, just giving people what they want. And I feel like
being like Jack Skellington.
That's what I'm saying.
Giving people what they want. Yeah.
Gives the people what they want, and he's ashamed of that. And so he has to make it that it's their problem. He can't be like, oh, but that's me. I like giving people what they want because I like having millions of dollars and a very big house and like sexy ladies who would never be with me otherwise if I was just making my like true art in a garret somewhere.
Right. Yeah. It's all an apologia.
Yeah, it is. It's an apologia. No, it's denial. It's denial. It's deep, deep denial about his own surrender of an aesthetic vision to a Hollywood like shtick.
But they never understood my, he has a cookie for a heart. They will never understand.
They'll never understand, but they still love it and want it anyway.
Yeah.
How painful must it be to have people love you
but
without
never
understanding you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's got to be hard. They love you for all the wrong reasons.
Tim Burton, in numerous interviews, has talked about the genesis of this story. And his explanation is that Halloween and Christmas were always his two favorite holidays. And so he liked the idea of them sort of like coming into contact and interacting. And my feeling on that is like, what the fuck about Thanksgiving? Thanksgiving gets no love.
Thanksgiving gets no love.
Why does everyone overlook it?
It's all about, because you have to give thanks. I mean, I just feel like there's no, well, first of all, are any of the sort of home for the holidays, meet the parents situations on Thanksgiving?
What do you mean?
Like, are any of those set on Thanksgiving? Because people fucking love Meet the Parents.
It's not set on Thanksgiving.
Okay.
Is it? I don't know. I don't remember like, there being a holiday.
Okay.
It's just that he's going to meet her parents because they're going to get married. I don't remember.
I don't know, because what kind of movie would you make about Thanksgiving?
Well, that's the thing. So this is a really interesting point you're making, which is about what narrative exists around Thanksgiving. How do you make a movie that feels like Thanksgiving? My take on it was always Thanksgiving gets overlooked because you can't sell people anything for Thanksgiving other than turkeys, right? And on Halloween, you're selling costumes and decorations and candy. And on Christmas, you're selling every fucking thing. So what are you selling on Thanksgiving? But then,
well, also because Thanksgiving is food and food only lasts for that week.
Right.
You can prepare for, you have weeks leading up to Halloween. You have weeks leading up to Christmas. Thanksgiving, it's like, that's it. You cook a turkey. That's the day. That's it.
Yeah, that's true. But you're sort of making the point that there are like narratives, there are stories we associate, or even like moods of stories that we associate with Halloween and Christmas. Whereas with Thanksgiving, what story are we really telling? I mean, there's the story of the pilgrims, but like, no one's making a movie of that. No, has anyone done that?
I don't think so.
No.
I mean, has there been the return of Squanto? Like,
I'm kind of actually somewhat surprised that that's not a movie.
There's
like
no
some romanticization of the pilgrim story, of the Thanksgiving story. Is Charlie Brown? Nope. Charlie Brown's Christmas.
I think that you've just figured out our first $1 million.
Right, right.
It's our first screenplay.
No, you can't now because everyone's going to be skeptical of it because we all know that the relationship between European settlers and indigenous people wasn't all charming.
That's what you make the movie about.
You do the brutally honest version.
Yes.
Where they ate lobster instead of turkey because that's what was available.
Or you do the sort of like big historical, you know, like Squanto, like you just do the big Spielberg.
No, but Spielberg's going to do it from the white people's point of view. You have to do it from Squanto's point of view.
Right. So you do it from Squanto's point of view, but it's still very like big and epic. And like you see the sort of pain of these white people who are so well-meaning, but they're just so racist. I feel like that movie needs to be made.
I feel like it's maybe too subtle. It's too complex.
Too soon?
Yeah, it's too soon.
I would love to be loved for all the wrong reasons by you, dear listener.
Yes, love us for whatever reason
you want to love us.
Honestly.
We'll take...
We're
not going to judge you and like make super condescending shit, even if you love us for the wrong reasons.
Just give us the numbers, okay? We want the listenership numbers. Whatever your reasons are.
Yeah, we don't care. Write us iTunes reviews, people.
I have a question for you, Maya, really quickly.
Yeah.
On Patreon, the crowdfunding site, I got a new patron, and as is my practice, I asked the patron where they found out about me and found out about my work. And they said that they were a listener of the podcast and had looked to see if our podcast had a Patreon. And since it didn't, and since you didn't have a Patreon, they became a patron of me, which I'm like, that's wonderful. But it makes me wonder if our podcast should have one. If that's something we should be thinking about maybe in the future.
That is something to think about. That's great. Who was it? Was it one of my friends?
No, it was a listener.
That's amazing.
So, listeners, I mean, no pressure. No pressure at all. But I'm curious, like, if we did start a Patreon, would you be willing to contribute? In large part, it would help us because if we could raise enough money to like hire an editor, that'd be fucking great. Make life easier.
Also, guys, I have this idea for Rebecca and I to do this video. It would be so good. There's this place in LA that we have to ruin for you guys. If we got support from you guys, that could help us do some new and daring things.
We could do video podcasts. It's something to think about.
Yeah, we'd love that support. That would be really good.
All right. Mm. Listeners, let us know if that's something you might be willing to support. Also, let us know what other stuff you might like us to ruin. And let us know your thoughts about this and any previous episodes that you've listened to, because we love hearing from you guys. You can reach us via email at saucepodcast@gmail.com, at saucepodcast on Twitter and Instagram.
You can find me at Maya Garance anywhere you're looking for Maya Garances.
You can find me as at GynoStar on all the social medias. Come join us. Have a conversation. We'd love to hear from you.
Do it.
All right. Have a great Thanksgiving, everyone. Adios, amibas.